today I'm actually going to talk to you about Copperman, and its funny sets of adventures. I don't think many mummies can claim to have seen the world quite as extensively as Copperman. So I'm just going to take you through several parts of the Copperman's history. First, about the discovery, of course, what we know about the discovery, and then the loss, and then the rediscovery of Copperman, the early scientific studies on Copperman, and the re-examination that I was able to do in 2005 when we took him out of his display at the American Museum of Natural History. And so Copperman was found in Chile, in Chuquicamata, which is actually in northern Chile, in the Atacama Desert, which is one of the most arid places in the world. And it was found towards the end of the 19th century in 1899. Chuquicamata is actually still an open, active copper mine. And you may know that Chile, actually the entire GDP of Chile, really depends on copper mining. Pretty much 100% of the world's copper comes from Chile, and particularly places like Chuquicamata. And I don't know if you see the extent of this is a little bit difficult to pinpoint when you're looking at it on a slide, but just to give you a little bit of perspective, see that tiny little black dot there? That is the size of probably 10 football fields. So you can imagine how big that hole in the ground here looks like. And it truly is a horrible pit of death, because the working conditions in Chuquicamata are extremely strenuous. And, you know, it wasn't so long ago that we all heard about those miners who got trapped in Chile. It was also in a mine similar to Chuquicamata. So the discovery of Copperman was made in 1899, and he was found in the very early exploitation of the mine in a very shallow shaft. And right away, the big issue with Copperman was the ownership. So who owned Copperman? There were two parties at war. There's one who was the French mine operator, and the other the American owner of the mine. So the French operator argued that because Copperman was covered in copper, therefore it was a copper ore and not an actual biological entity, and it belonged to him. The American owner, of course, said, "Mine is mine. Too bad. It's ours." And that eventually led to a third party called Jackson, an American. People like to call him entrepreneur. I would call him madman, who decided to buy the mummy and exhibit it at home, kind of as a freak show. And so very early on, Copperman was really part of the freak shows and the circuses of the world. So it, from the moment it was sold to this Jackson guy, it went on show after show after show after show. The mummy was loaned to people, then it was sold to another party. It eventually made it to the United States, and of all places, Buffalo. at the Pan American Exposition in 1901, where Copperman was actually described as petrified human remains. And we talked a little bit with Jenny about petrification. You'll see that that has nothing to do with petrification, even though Copperman is covered in copper. And very early on, actually, Copperman was thought to be a woman. And we'll see why. Eventually, after years of being on the road and part of those years where the mummy was actually lost to records, where we didn't actually know where the mummy was, J.P. Morgan saw the mummy at an exhibit and decided to buy it off in 1905 and hand it over right away to the Museum of Natural History. He knew that the importance of the remains and thought right away that this would make a great contribution to the people of the Americas galleries that the mummy was putting together the museum was putting together at the time. So fast forward exactly 100 years later, M&H gets contacted by Codelco, which is the biggest copper miner in the copper miner industry in Chile, which basically means that Codelco rules Chile. Vastly, vastly rich. I mean, pretty much owns the entire GDP of Chile in its own hands. Contacts AM&H, says, hey, we're putting this massive exhibit on copper mining in Chile, and we would like Copperman on loan. And at the time, I was working at the AM&H as curatorial staff, and lo and behold, they realized that I was the only person who was doing what I was doing, so I was the only forensic anthropologist there. So they asked me to have a look and assess Copperman. Well, when I say have a look and assess, it's a little bit difficult because Chile was, of course, interested not just in getting Copperman on loan, but it was interested in... That's right, in repatriation, right? In repatriation of the remains. Now, if you know anything about the law on antiquities, as long as a museum has acquired or has bought off the object legally, you cannot have a case for repatriation. Fortunately, Copperman has had such a long history of being bought, sold, loaned, and it's changing so many hands and being lost that the records are so blurred that actually Chile might have a case. And so while I was assessing the mummy, they were actually asking me or sort of prodding me in from behind saying, please don't tell them that it's actually viable for travel. Tell them that it's too fragile. And so... I actually kind of agreed because Copperman had already lost several digits in the years that it traveled on loan from the time it had been found. And it was a little bit, actually, it was fragile, but for my estimation, it would have made the repatriation, it would have made the travel if you packed it properly. Still, it was a great opportunity for me to actually do an scientific examination of the mummy, which actually had been forgotten even by the curators of the museum themselves. And so the first step was actually to do a replica. And why did we do a replica? Well, we did a replica because we're basically told... Codelco, no, we can't send Copperman back. They said, okay, fine, we'll do with a replica. They brought in a team from the United States, from California, who specialized at the time in replicas of art pieces to do a replica of the mummy, which they had never done before. And so the technique that they used to do the replica was a 3D white light surface scanning. And Jenny, you were asking about anybody having done surface video. Actually, 3D white light scanning is exactly that. What you have is two video on each side and a scanner at the center, which actually simultaneously take pictures of about 10 micron resolution each. And scan every single detail of the surface of the object in front of it. And the resolution was so high that when we saw the resulting image, we were able to zoom in onto the fingerprint of Copperman, which were not readily visible with the naked eye. So that's how high a resolution we had for the replica. So they built up the replica from, so they carved out the replica from the scanner. And of course, it came out completely white. The replica itself had to be painted. Chile brought in an artist who was called in to paint the Copperman the way he looked on display. And several weavers from the Atacama Desert were also brought to replicate the clothing that were still on Copperman, and unfortunately, that is just a wig. the replica has had a wig to replicate, of course, the hair that's still present on Copperman itself. But you can see that the replica is very, very accurate looking. This is actually my own personal picture, so there's some color distortion, but the color is closer in that particular image, so the Copperman really does look very, very green, not this shade of brownish. So that went travel to Chile and is now actually still on display at the museum in Santiago de Chile as part of the Chilean Miner exhibit. But opening the casing, which was in itself a scientific discovery, because nobody remembered how the casing of Copperman had been made. It had been that long since it had been put into display and forgotten into the whole of South American people. And it was actually a really great opportunity for me to start doing a couple of scientific studies, trying at the same time not to disrupt the mummy as much as possible. I mean, it's both a human being and an artifact, and it's an artifact that doesn't belong to this culture, so you have to be very sensitive about what kind of work you're doing on it. And so trying not to be destructive while performing the scientific studies. And so to start the scientific studies, I went back to the study of Junius Bird, who at the time was a curator at the Museum of Natural History from the late 60s to the early 80s. He had done the one and only scientific study on Copperman, and that actually provided me with many incredible surprises, something that actually you only hear about in, I don't know, the History Channel, I guess. Very, very bizarre for a scientific such as Junius Bird to do something like what I'm going to show you. So Junius Bird's study is very important for one very crucial part of the history of Copperman. It's the dating of Copperman. And so he used radiocarbon dating to date the tool and the miner. So he both sampled the tools and the miner. The tools were thought to be fake and added after the fact, but in fact they turned out the same radiocarbon date, which was 550 AD, which more or less corresponds to the at the time in South America to the expansion of the Tiwanaku Empire. And as you know, the Tiwanakus are the precursors of the Incas. So with Junius Bird, we have a date for Copperman-ish. But surprisingly, I mean, when you look at Copperman, one of the first things that strikes you is how beautifully preserved he is. And he has his hair, you can see his finger, the body is not completely beef jerky-ish looking like an Egyptian mummy. It's, and you know, you see that he's got this wonderful hip going, and that's part of the reason why many people thought at first that it was a woman because of the sort of prominent hips. Turns out that if they had peeked under the loincloth, they would have noticed. But, you know, just saying. Sometimes people are not curious. But Bird, who went to such length to date Copperman, makes almost no remark on the preservation of the body. He just says, well, there was a report written in 1921 by somebody called Robert Sullivan. We don't even know who that was. He was part of the staff of the museum at the time, but we're not sure who he was. He told us that the stature of Copperman was 157 centimeters. Yay, great. Wow. And he was an adult man in the prime of life. Okay. And then he was covered with a copper layer that was strictly superficial. Right. Okay. So very basic observation. Really somebody who really actually didn't pull the long cloth much. In the publication, he mentioned a report of Sullivan who says, or who actually conjectures, that Copperman is so well preserved because the crushing stone that killed him actually pushed the blood to the extremities. That, combined with the aridity of the Atacama Desert, is actually what created the mummy of Copperman. Well, that's not quite true at all, as a matter of fact. Here is a body that's been preserved in the Atacama Desert very much in the same condition as Copperman would have been. And you can see that he's not faring nearly as well as Copperman. Right? Well, that's because Copperman beneficiated from something a little extra. And a little extra that happens to a fair amount of bodies. What happened is the body fat of Copperman turned into soap. And what I'm showing you here is actually another mummy that I worked on called the Yuyayako Maiden. She's a mummy of a late Inca girl in Argentina, who was found in Argentina, found at the top of a volcano as a sacrifice to the earth goddess. And you can see what happened here is that none of the hallmark of decomposition show on the body at all, whether it's desiccation or eating by bacteria or sagging of the skin. None of that shows because her body fat, her subcutaneous fat, turned into soap. And that's a process called adipocere. Now, you know that if you want to make soap, you need lard, right? That's the first ingredient of soap. This is exactly the same process. How does that happen? Well, it happens usually in cool and damp environment, which sounds a little bit bizarre. You think that damp environment automatically is going to actually accelerate decomposition. Not quite. If it's damp, just damp enough, it's actually going to create that process. But it can also happen in hot and dry environment as long as the environment is completely anaerobic, meaning that there's absolutely no oxygen whatsoever. Now, with Copperman, what happened is a combination of all of those elements at the same time. The Atacama Desert has this wide variety of temperature. So it's 40 degrees during the day Celsius, so that's like 110 Celsius during the day. And at night, it plunges to 30 degrees Fahrenheit. So 101 Fahrenheit, 32 degrees Fahrenheit, so 40 to zero in Celsius. Very hot during the day, very cool during the night. Copperman was found in a shaft that had collapsed. That's how he died. But there's another thing that you should be noticing from the mummy itself. What are you noticing? Let's see if you are, if there are some future forensic anthropologists in the room.
His hands are in very odd positions.
Right, absolutely. Future forensic anthropologists. Very odd position to be, particularly if you're dying crushed by stone. It's a little bit odd. What else?
The position of the body looks a little different, right?
It's a little bit odd. So that's probably because of also the... So that what you have here is an artist's rendition that was in that was actually penned for La Nación, which is a newspaper in Chile that was produced at the time where the exhibition opened. The body is a little bit contortion because of the shallow shaft itself. Having to dig into this very, very shallow shaft when you have nothing holding back the ceiling above you, just literally digging like a mole into this open mine, create this contortion. But also, let's remember that the shaft collapsed. And we don't know how shallow the shaft was at the time of the collapse, because by the time they reached the mummy in the 19th century, of course, they had already peeled several layers of the ground above it. So we're not entirely certain how much of a crush that would have been and how deep the shaft would have been. But one of the things that struck me with Copperman is that he looks very peaceful. Like, his hands are sort of resting on the stone that supports them. One of them is still clutching something, which is clutching a tool that he was holding at a time of death. But the facial expression of Copperman himself is actually incredibly peaceful. And so two things happen. Yes, he was crushed by the weight of the shaft, but then he was still alive for a little bit. After, I know it's horrible, it's like everybody's worst nightmare. He was still alive after the shaft collapsed and was probably trying to dig himself out and eventually died of CO2 poisoning from his own breath. As the oxygen was depleted, as he was breathing, he basically fell asleep trying to dig himself out and didn't probably feel anything by the time he fell asleep. He just never woke up. Well, didn't feel anything. Probably super, super terror, but... but if you're going to die, CO2 poisoning is actually not so bad, she says. Let me tell you, in my line of work, I see a lot of people dying much worse. So... the shaft was collapsed around him. The oxygen was completely gone, so that created a perfect anaerobic environment. And then copper that was surrounding him, that was why he was there. Copper, what is the property of copper?
Metal.
It's metal.
Skin doctor.
Skin doctor, in what way?
Carries
electric pulse, and
it tends to adhere, or it tends to travel and connect with other materials.
Absorbs.
Yes, it's a very good conductor. Yeah, absorbs what?
Oxidizes.
It oxidizes. Yes, in a beautiful green color. Yes, it's a very good oxidizer. It reacts beautifully with oxygen. That's why you can't keep any copper unless you just every day you're like polish it. You'll get it turning green no matter what. Yes, I mean, you mean absorbed into the body's metabolism, you mean? Yes, the body actually can absorb part of copper into the metabolism. But I'm thinking in terms of a forensic anthropologist here. Why is copper such a great element in the preservation of this mummy?
It also acts as a
sealant. Sealant, yes. It seals to what? Sealant to what?
The skin. And? The bone and bone.
Well, the skin and bone are
and
not...
fat.
And?
And soap.
No.
No?
Oh, what? I'm trying to get... If it's a sealant, then...
Moisture? It's antibacterial.
No. Yes. It's antibacterial, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Copper is antibacterial. That's why all of the railings, yes, railings for stairs and doorknobs are made of copper because it's a natural antibacterial, so you don't have to follow people around with, you know, Lysol to clean your railings and your doorknobs. That's actually the reason why it was made out of copper. So copper, a great antibacterial, great, because we don't want decomposition. And one of the actors of decomposition is, of course, external bacteria coming in to actually lyse the tissue of Copperman. Now, there's another tiny little part of this. I told you that cool and damp is important, and anaerobic environment is important. We are in the most arid region in the entire world. Where are you going to get dampness? Even if you are in a shallow shaft in a mine, it's still dry as hell.
Is it condensation?
Condensation of what? It's condensation, that's a great, yes, condensation chair number four. She's halfway right.
I don't know.
What is condensating in that tomb?
Air, steam,
the heat.
His own body fluid?
Yes, the body fluid. The body is actually condensating at the same time. And because the copper hasn't sealed it completely yet, because of course that... the event just happened, the body's own moisture comes out of the body as the Copperman dies, and then it's bounced back by actually the shaft sealing it into the body, creating that chemical reaction of turning the body fat into soap. Now, if Copperman had been a skinny little dude, there's no way he would have turned into the mummy that you're seeing today. For that process to happen, you actually need the person to be fairly corpulent, let's just put it that way. So that's why I said earlier, die fat, make a beautiful body. And so... unfortunately, because Copperman was removed from his natural environment, ever since it was removed, it started suppurating. And that was the first question that the curator had for me when we took out Copperman from his shallow grave at the museum. Why is the Copperman looking shiny in places, like here? And you can see here as well. That's actually the fat turning back, the body's soap turning back into fat and separating through some of the areas of the body. So technically, Copperman is actually decomposing, which is a big preservation problem, which of course means that the museum is going to have to recreate very quickly the environment in which Copperman was originally found to prevent decomposition from happening on the body of the miner. Unforeseen problems that you get when you're a museum curator. And then I had my WTF moment. So, using Junius Bird's study as my guide, I thought, okay, so even if it was 1979, they still had X-ray, right? And they did perform an X-ray, so I'm going to look at the original plate of those X-rays, which of course were available to me at any hour at the Museum of Natural History. So I looked at the plate, and then I realized, wait a minute, something's really very wrong here. Now, there's a lot of artists in the room, so you probably already picked out the seven errors, but I'm just going to point them out to you. First of all, what the hell is this? This has been drawn in. Literally, you can see the pencil marks
right over there
to pretend that it's a broken bone. What the hell is going on here? And then you got a shoulder going nowhere. I mean, that could be a camel's shoulder if it was a three parts joint, but in a human being, that's not possible. And this has been published in a very prestigious bulletin of the Museum of Natural History. And then finally, I just thought, but wait a minute, the leg is not in the right position. The leg on Copper Man is under the leg that's actually bent is under the leg that is elongated. While on the X-ray, which is obviously taken from the same side as the Copper Man is lying on, the leg is above the bent leg is above the elongated one. And you can see that it's actually anatomically impossible. I mean, you just, if you look at the picture of Copperman, this cannot be the X-ray of Copperman. So we are looking at a scientific fraud, complete scientific fraud, which was unknown from anybody because nobody had looked at Copperman in ages and ages. And then the final seventh error was just the nail in the coffin of Copperman. Wow, those are great teeth for an ancient body. I mean, how many teeth does this have? Seriously. So who the hell, who was this? So I started actually digging through the museum's archive. And through a lot of digging, I finally came up with this image, which was an X-ray that was taken by the New York University team in 1988. It was two X-rays that were almost discarded into a folder that was leaning on a folder case that was about to be thrown away by the museum. This actually is a real X-ray of Copperman. And you can see the difference between the fake and the real. Even if you didn't know that, if you didn't have that, there would be no problem saying that this was an absolute fake. Why Junius Bird did that, we don't know. We can't understand why he did that. But it gives you a very good appreciation of the actual skull of Copperman. And you can see that Copperman has a skull deformation, which is actually almost tried to be replicated in that fake, but not quite. And so this image actually gave me a little bit of information to actually place Copperman geographically. Now, it was found in Chile, but was he actually Chilean? We are not sure about that. And he was a corpulent man going into the mines with actually artifacts around him and no sign of arthritis. He didn't seem like he was an actual miner by profession. So where was Kupperman actually from? Maybe these x-rays are going to be able to tell us where he was from. So that was my point of origin to start digging Kupperman's past and past origin. Now we know that Junius Bird's assessment of Kupperman probably should not be taken at face value. However, he was actually very prudent about giving Kupperman an origin. He didn't basically give one origin over the other. He said, well, the artifacts could be from the northern coast of Chile or southern Peru-ish, not quite sure. From the skull, the early report that included did mention that the occiput of the individual was flattened. Well, you can see here, so you have the occipital bone and the frontal bone that are kind of flattened. These are actually deformation that are common in Andean people. And they are produced in a way that I will show you. So you have two types of cranial deformation that happen in the Andes. And if you're unfortunate enough that you've seen Indiana Jones and the Kingdom Skull or whatever the title was, that was the type of skull that was in that movie. And not at all alien, but in fact, absolutely human, just a mark of ethnicity in the Andean civilizations. And not just the Andean civilizations, as a matter of fact, some of the Middle Eastern civilization also used practiced cranial deformation as a mark of particular ethnic group. The ethnic groups represented in the Andean cranial deformation had several types of deformation that marked them over the others. The highland, which were the highland of Bolivia, further away from the coasts, tend to have an annular type of deformation, more rounded type of deformation, while the coastal that were non-Tiwanaku of influence, so non-Bolivian influence, tend to be more tabular, so flatter. Well, Kupperman was actually a difficult case because he was a tabular oblique, or what we call a frontal occipital. Why do we call it frontal occipital? So what it means is that when Kupperman was born, his parent put a plank of wood against against his frontal bone and against its occiput, tied up really tightly the skull, and the bones that were not completely formed at the time were still cartilage. Any firstborn child doesn't have a bony skeleton. It's still cartilaginous, thank God, because otherwise we'd never be able to give birth. As the bone was not formed, the bone would ossify in that weird shape that you're seeing, the tabular oblique shape. And that would be the mark of that particular ethnic group that Kupperman came from. So the ethnic group that tended to practice this type of deformation was more characteristic of the western coast of Peru. So not the highlands. But it was also a type that was represented in San Pedro de Atacama. So the shape didn't really give us a precise location for Kupperman. We kind of have an ID, but it could belong to anywhere over here or anywhere over there. So if you want to think of it in terms of square miles, it's an area that's equivalent of probably the width of the height of the United States and the height of Canada put together, not exactly precise as a geographical location. So the skull shape give us an ID, but not great ID. But then if you look at Kopperman's jaw, there's something that you will notice right away that'll make you brush your teeth. Yeah? Yeah, it's lacking in teeth, right? There's definitely a big hole in there. And the Kopperman's mouth is actually shut tight, so you can't get into the mouth. So those teeth were not taken out post-mortem. Those teeth came out during the life of Kopperman. You can also see that the jaw bones are severely retracted, which is what happens when a tooth falls. That's why actually if one of your tooth fell, you would go to the dentist and they would immediately put an implant, because if a tooth falls, the bone starts retracting completely very quickly, and that's why the older generation used to have dental implants that would never fit because the bone would retract more and more, and they would keep falling because the structure of the bone would actually change year to year as it was retracting. The teeth actually allows us, the visualization of the teeth allows us to give an age to Kopperman. Anywhere between 30 years old and 40 years old, we can tell by the loss of teeth, the structure of the teeth. You can still see the molars right here, and the general wear and tear, which you can actually see on the X-ray right behind me. You can also see a cavity on the last molar, so definitely in need of a great dentist. Another thing that's apparent here is that you can see the beginning of the roots coming out of the jaw, serious periodontal disease. And that is a characteristic of something very famous in the Andes, or in the Andean region, which is what? Everybody's going to think about a disease. Don't think about a disease.
Something to do with diet?
Yes.
Yeah.
So think Andes, think high plateaus. What part of your diet would be particularly essential in the Andes? Has anybody here gone into the high Andes? Has anybody gone to Machu Picchu? Yes? Okay. Have you gone higher than Machu Picchu?
Yeah.
Have you been kind of sick?
Yes.
Have you?
The altitude, you can. It's really low. Air pressure or whatever?
Yeah. The oxygen is rarer at those altitude. Has anybody offered you coca tea?
Yes.
Okay. This is what it is. That tooth loss and that pattern of erosion of the jaw is actually absolutely synonymous with coca chewing, which is something that the civilization of the Andes have always done ever since they found out the properties of coca and are still doing nowadays. In fact, the mummy that I showed you earlier, which is actually another story itself, had a ball of coca leaves in her cheek as she died, as a matter of fact. So that pattern of erosion is coca chewing. So does that tell us more where Kopperman had lived before? Well, not really. The area is still as wide open as it was before. So the only thing that could really help with determining Kopperman's origin would actually be the DNA studies. Unfortunately, the only DNA studies that I was able to perform were on material that had been taken away from Kopperman before I got there, and it was not a very successful biopsy, and I didn't want to be more intrusive to the mummy. So it was completely inconclusive because the DNA was way too degraded. And, it was 2005. the technology was actually, believe it or not, not the same as now nowadays. If I did that nowadays, it would actually probably be a lot more successful with the new technology that we're getting. Another thing is, from the DNA, the haplogroups of Amerindians is not very precise. What is a haplogroup? Well, haplogroup is basically the sequences of DNA that make a group of persons similar to one another. And so between different tribes of Amerindia, the variation are minute and sometimes really not precise from one area to the other because the areas are so close geographically. And so just to give you an idea of what it would take to dig the DNA of Copperman, well, it's not just well and beautiful to take the DNA of Copperman and recover it. You still have to sample sort of similar bodies, so mummies from all over the area, to compare the DNA of Copperman against the others, because the DNA of just one individual is not going to tell you anything. So these are all the potential tribes that would have to be compared with their variety in haplogroup that would have to be compared to Copperman to be able to infer which tribe Copperman actually belonged to. And that's a lot of tribes. So that's work that would take 5 years in a minimum and a lot of cooperation from Chile. Unfortunately, that's not going to happen until Copperman is given back to Chile. And that's the problem that we are facing with Copperman right now. And so with that, I would like to thank you all and would love to hear your questions. Thank you very much. Any question? Yes. So it's as you know, most of the ancient cultures of that area didn't actually have a recorded written history. So we're not quite certain of what was going on. But we can infer by symmetries that it was both an ethnic mark as well as a mark of social class. So somebody had suggested to me at one point that Copperman may actually have been a priest, which explained his rather corpulent nature, actually looking for copper ore for particular rituals, and that was part of the spiritual journey to go pick up your own copper ore and bring it back to your village. Which is actually, it kind of makes sense to me. It may have been actually a mark of perhaps the dedication of that particular child to priesthood, but at least we know that it is ethnic based. So different ethnicities will have different type of deformation, and it's not to resemble aliens. Yes.
At some point, I think it was in the 20s and 30s that the American Museum was the host of the American Eugenics Society.
Oh, yeah.
And also, did they have two Eskimo or Alouette father and son living there?
Actually, it was the American Museum of Natural History combined with Cold Spring Harbor, which was the other big eugenic movement. But yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Good times.
But I think they've actually gone completely the other way inside. Well, I saw a water exhibit there, and they had no problems of exercising economic interest.
Right. No. If you actually question curatorial staff about the eugenic movement and EMNH, they won't even answer you. I mean, they basically will blabber something about, well, just like Volkswagen doesn't want to associate themselves with Hitler, they will distance themselves from it. But it's definitely part of the past of the museum, and one that I actually like to highlight when I give lectures at John Jay to my students, to say, never believe that an institution is above something, is above evil. You know, absolute, you know, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely.
But also, I got to say that my last name is Kupferman. It's Kupferman.
Sorry?
My last name is Kupferman.
Uh huh.
Which is Copperman.
Oh, is it really? Oh, wow. So you are the Copperman.
That's my uncle I've come
to meet. Okay. Well, it's on 81st Street West. Go get him and bring it back. I personally am of the opinion that Copperman should go back where he belongs, to Chile. But that I don't think that's going to happen.
But also, I'm an environmental attorney, and there's something good about copper, about any, using an element as a surface, not just being antibacterial.
Mm-hmm.
That it lasts for a long, long time.
Yeah.
I think it was in the 50s, there was like a major shift in materials that people used for building and even furniture that was plating. So in some ways, you know, you have something that lasted hundreds and thousands of years, and now we have things that are plated that last 5, 10, 15 years.
Right.
It's something about using solid materials in terms of recycling and negative effects on the...
You know, that, yeah, that's absolutely true. Actually, copper is very malleable. So if you know Horta, the famous architect, the Art Nouveau architect, Art Deco, sorry. it's been a long time since my art history courses. Anyway, he had the idea of, if you've ever had a wood floor at home, you hear it crack all the time and expand, and eventually you're going to have to replace it. He had the idea to surround the areas where you had the wood floor with a copper lining, because copper can expand and contract with the heat like wood, and that would actually accommodate the wood flooring much better and prevent it from creaking and creasing at night and freak you out in the middle of your sleep.
Well, that, I think an architectural historian restorer, and a lot of the farmhouses upstate, it was amazing, the louvers here were made of copper and other metals that they would know that would expand and contract, you know, during certain seasons. So they were
made of that, and you know, let's not forget the horology contribution to copper. Without copper, we wouldn't know what the longitude of anywhere is. It's copper that actually created the watch that was so accurate that it could actually tell you where you were at sea. Sorry, did we diverge? Yes. There's no dumb question.
That came up.
Yeah.
And that I mixed up whenever I wrote the Museum of Natural History about Copperman.
Mm-hmm.
What is the difference between fossilization, petrification, and desiccation? Because these are all very different.
Yeah.
The different ways that a body, I guess, ages over time. So what is the difference?
Okay, so desiccation is basically the beef jerky thing. Desiccation is the removal of all moisture from a body or from, you know, any kind of organism. So either it's natural by heat or it's aided by salts, which will absorb the water in the body and remove it completely, like the Egyptian mummies. The Egyptian used to bury their the dead under a pile of salt for 70 days as part of the mummification process so that the body would desiccate and preserve, just like beef jerky. Sorry. I keep going back to that. But fossilization and petrification is essentially the same thing. It's the turning of organic matter into inorganic matter. So you turn the organic part of a body into a stone-like state, which is not the case of Copperman. He's still very much organic, except for the copper that covers him and the hydroxyapatite in his bones. Those are the only things that are inorganic in Copperman.
So what's the right term?
he's mummified. He's naturally mummified, so he's a soap mummy.
Yeah.
Unlikely, because he's no longer in the area where he's no longer in the environment that would help fossilization, which actually for that he would need to be buried in the ground, in a very special type of ground, like a tar pit or a bog of very specific chemical composition, which is what happened to those dinosaurs that we are now finding all over the place. Well, in places that had those tar pits and those special kind of bogs.
So what kind of conditions do they need to keep him in now to stop him degrading?
Completely anaerobic, okay. Tiny little bit humid, and very, very cool. So a very...
It's a hard balance, right?
It's a hard balance. Well, for the mummy that I showed you, which I also was... a consultant for the actual preservation, this one, we had two problems. We also had to preserve her as she was. I mean, you're staring at the face of an Inca. Not that the Inca no longer exists. It still exists as a people. However, an Inca from the late Inca Empire, before the Inca Empire fell. So the way we did that, the cool environment that we created was with liquid nitrogen, because liquid nitrogen replaces oxygen in a room in an enclosed space at a rate of 600 to 1 particles. So it's completely anaerobic. And so that way she preserves her beautiful features.
How come her hair is so well preserved?
Yes. It's sweet that you're saying the hair, but don't you think the face is a little more? I mean, so the hair, do you want me to talk to you about that?
Yeah.
Okay, let me just very quickly load that. It's going to come up any time now. There we go. So that's not her. She's not walking around like this in a creepy manner. That was actually an actress that was chosen by... National Geographic to play her on their show, which, as you can see, is very successful. It's, as I said, the Incas are not dead. Most people think of the Incas as a dead civilization, which I find a complete insult to the actual Inca who are left. But anyway, so let me try to find... Machu Picchu. All right, so they were found here on the volcano, really far up, 6,000 meters above sea level, almost 7,000 meters, so that's 1,000 meters shy of Everest. They were found in three graves like this, environment very similar to Copperman, but on top of that, they beneficiated it from the fact that they were freezing temperature where they were. And so they were very, very well preserved. And so this is the little boy.
Wow.
You can see that he's beautifully preserved together, all together with his the clothes that we had never been able to see before, and a beautiful feathered headdress. There's a little girl, and she unfortunately... was unfortunate after death, just so that, you know, some people just can't rest in peace. She was struck by lightning after death because she had a headrest made of copper that stuck out and, of course, attracted lightning. At that altitude, lightning falls all the time. And so she was charred across her face. But you can still see the incredible preservation state that she has. You can see that her eye is still visible.
That's her teeth?
That's her teeth. That's her eyes. That's her eyelash. That's her. This is who she is.
So from when are they?
Oh, in late Inca Empire, they are about 500 years old. See?
I would always criticize movies that go back, you know, show people 500,000 years ago. everything is, it seems imperfect because they have perfect teeth.
Uh-huh.
But this, you can have perfect teeth.
You can have perfect teeth, yes. This
why.
Yeah, it's a child, and also they're not as perfect as you think, because she has a volcanic ashes inside the mouth, which is, of course, because of the burial where they were. And so it's hiding the imperfection, which were that she was grinding her teeth heavily, because actually she kind of knew that she was going to be killed. This is the Doncella that I showed you, and her beautiful hairstyle is, actually hair is extremely resilient to decomposition. In fact, hair will remain way after your body has ever your body is completely gone, including your bones. But her hairstyle is as perfect as the day she was killed. And she was not killed violently. She was actually drugged and fell into a coma. And of course, if you fall into a coma at 6,000 meters high, you don't wake up from that. And so you see that she has her cheek is slightly swollen. That's the bowl of coca leaves that I was talking to you about earlier. And you can see still bits and pieces of the leaves on her lips. Here's a picture of her arms, which is unbelievable. When I
was the structure of it?
Exactly like human skin, just very, very cold.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's like human skin is elastic.
Yeah, it's still elastic. When I took the biopsy, I took a biopsy in her neck, the skin would have been just as pliable.
Is it?
Sorry?
Is it actually skin?
Yeah.
Oh,
okay.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The skin was as pliable as a you know, contemporary patient.
How old is she?
She's 500 years old.
So would that be mummification or desiccation?
That's mummification exactly the same way as Copperman, but more successful than Copperman even. That's the adipocere, yeah, the soap process.
So
a fourth word for you to remember now.
So has anything from what these discoveries of the soap process and something sort of the copper gone over into medical science in terms of looking at preservation or disease prevention? Or like, does it have broader implications?
Oh, yeah, actually, this was the point of this talk. The talk was not at all about the mummies. Well, it was about the mummies, but the talk that I gave for this presentation was about the... So my team was the first one to ever recover the immune system response to a pathogen from an ancient body. And that was what the talk was about. So we were able to detect the immune system... her immune system response to a pathogen that's close to tuberculosis.
Mm-hmm.
So she was fighting an upper respiratory disease at the time of her death that we actually were able to detect in her saliva and her the blood that was on her lips.
But I mean more in terms of, does it have implications?
Yep, it does. So.
Oh,
by the way, that's how they're preserved. Those are the pots in which they are preserved. Yes. So this is all the medical facts. Da, da, da. Medical moraine. Okay.
How old was she?
She was about 15 years old.
15.
Yeah. So this is the point at which I'm saying, so actually, from the study of the pathogen that we recovered from her, we are now, a colleague and I, who's a biological engineer, are putting together a new tuberculosis vaccine, which is the bioengineering part is that we're making it into a patch, so a needle-less vaccine, which you can keep on your shelf for 2 years. And my part, which is the biological part, is that I've identified a new protein that's much more efficient than the BCG that we have right now for vaccinating, which is only 60% protective against tuberculosis. Now, this protein will not only protect you against tuberculosis, but also resistant tuberculosis and leprosy, for those of you who might be at risk of leprosy. But leprosy is within the same genus as tuberculosis. It's basically the cutaneous formation of tuberculosis. So, yes, we're able to transform what we learn from her. Mm-hmm. And so she may actually, in the future, give life to many people. So it's a weird kind of destiny. She was killed to protect her people from a catastrophe, and we think that the catastrophe was the arrival of the Spaniards. Mm-hmm. And yet her destiny might be that she will save millions of lives in the future. So it worked. Oh, wait. So, yeah.
Because I didn't understand all this, but how come that nobody ever, do we still have that in our bodies now? Or, like, so how can you, make it if it doesn't?
Yeah, so what we did is an evolutionary analysis using the sequence that we retrieved from the pathogen in the maiden against the modern strain of tuberculosis. And by calculating that, we were able to identify proteins that were common to all of them, but that wouldn't kill other bacteria. So that are not common to any other type of bacteria. And so by identifying those proteins, you can go and disrupt them and bring them down. Does it make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Ish? Yeah, well, your body right now is continuously making things. Every new virus that it gets, your immune system will go meet the virus, say, ooh, I don't know what that is. But then we'll go to another immune cell and says, hey, I don't know what that is, but you better look out for it because I don't recognize it anywhere. So call the macrophages, and the macrophages come in and chomp. But that other cell, that other immune cell, is the brain cell of the immune system. It will remember that signal and produce an antibody for that virus. That's the principle behind immunization and vaccines. And that's how we generate an antibody to that protein so that the body can respond to that right away. Yeah?
I just wanted to simplify for myself. Just so vaccine is kind of reminder to the brain how to struggle with the thing.
That's right. Well, a vaccine is basically a memory that you inject into your immune system. Yeah. So when your immune system encounters that pathogen, it says, ha, I know who you are. I know how to destroy you. I'll attack that protein that I know is destructive. So we basically telling our immune system what to do.
So this thing that you found in the woman is a memory that you think could help us in contemporary life, like a memory from 500 years ago.
That's exactly what it is. It's a memory ingrained into her immune system. And so we recovered both her memory and what triggered that memory.
Wow. Is that what being a forensic anthropologist is, as opposed to just, as I sort of thought, all anthropologists.
Yes.
By nature, but is it because you're a forensic anthropologist?
That's right, yeah. It used to be called physical anthropology, but there's now a split between physical anthropology, which is more, so a forensic anthropologist is a little bit more diverse in their training. So we also, into what we do, I can do both modern scenes as well as ancient. So, you know, I go on crime scene as well as I go on excavations. So, and I've veered very much towards the biomedical world. So that's also a sort of more, it's more diverse, and you know, I don't like to be boxed in terms of ID, so that is a field that really suited me very well, because I really don't like to be called a blah. I find that it's very reductive.